I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick talks with the physician and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Siddhartha Mukherjee. Mukherjee's new book, The Gene, An Intimate History, explores both what is beneficial and what is dangerous about our increasing ability to manipulate the human genome.
Now, I don't think you can possibly overhype the work of Siddhartha Mukherjee. His book about cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, won the Pulitzer Prize, and for really good reason. It's a huge, sweeping book that it's as good a science book as I've ever read. It really is. And his new book, out just this week, is called The Gene, An Intimate History. And if anything, it ups the ante. Every aspect of the life sciences today involves genetics. And our understanding of what it means to be human is largely based on the principle of the gene. Mukherjee seems to engage all of it. I'd like to begin as the book begins, which is personally. You have mental illness running in your family. There's no other way to put it. And you've got a cousin who suffers from mental illness and two uncles who did as well. Do you worry sometimes about your own mental health? And how big an issue was this, your family history, when you were getting closer to your now wife, Sarah? It's an enormous looming issue, obviously, in your book and in your life.
I began to discover it as a child myself. Like most Bengali families, my family had elevated denial to a high museum-grade art form. So we didn't talk about it very much. One of my uncles lived with us. He was quite ill mentally, so he had to live with us. So it was there in your face, but not talked about, why we would have a grown man living in your family, unemployed, unable to carry a job, often unable to carry out a full conversation. And then, of course, I knew later when my cousin first visited, it was also clear that he was quite ill. I describe an episode in which he comes in. We're about to go see a film. It was actually Spider-Man, if I remember correctly, one of the first early releases, just come to India. And he couldn't be found anywhere. And he had gone into the bathroom upstairs, and he was curled up in the bathroom, and my grandmother had to pull him out of the bathroom. So that was clear. And then the final piece of it became clear over time, and that was when I figured out that the other uncle who had died, all of these are, of course, blood-related. They're related to my father's side of the family.
And he died in a kind of manic episode.
He died in what was clearly a manic episode. And, you know, he was a larger-than-life figure in the family. He was so big. My grandmother used to call me by his name, which was, at first I thought was a slip of her tongue, but in fact she was actually living that fantasy that I had been reborn as him. He died several years before I was born. So all of these pieces were sort of loosely floating around the great unspoken in the Mukherjee family. Until I began to study medicine, basically, and realized that this was the reality of the illness that had run through the family. There was a genetic component to this illness.
Sid, you call the gene one of the most powerful and dangerous ideas in the history of all of science. It seems to me that our pretty recent genetic knowledge coming out of the Human Genome Project and all the rest is maybe even greater both in its potential and its dangers than the splitting of the atom.
And in fact, I draw a formal analogy between those two moments. The splitting of the atom really opened up the possibility of controlling energy and matter. So that opens up an immense technological possibility full of promise and perils, the promise being nuclear technology, the peril being Fukushima. But the genome also opens up that idea of promise and peril. So the promise being the curing of deadly diseases, the early diagnosis of breast cancer, the capacity of being able to predict in our children those that will carry devastating mutations that will make them potentially have lives of extraordinary suffering. But the peril is also questions like identity. What if we learn, and we are going to learn, about maybe not one gene, multiple genes that govern sexual identity? What if we learn about genes that predisposed to illness but don't cause extraordinary suffering? What should we do about those?
And the decisions to abort or not abort that would come along with it.
That's right. And just to give you one example, this is not fantasy. In India and in China, based on very crude genetic diagnosis of whether you're a boy or a girl, that phenomenon is already in action and has skewed the selective abortion of those diagnosed genetically as female, or they maybe potentially some infanticized, has skewed the gender ratio in India and China to something absurd, 700 women to 1,000 men in some parts of India and similarly in some parts of China. So
in a sense, the tragic mistakes are already being made at an early stage.
That's right. The tragedy is not tomorrow's tragedy. It is today's tragedy. In fact, it's yesterday's tragedy. Those societies have already been destabilized by genetics.
Your readers know you well from your first book on cancer. And genetics is a part of your work as a researcher as well as a doctor. Was the impulse to write this book on the gene and genetics, its history, an intimate history, you call it, propelled mainly by the family story, or you thought this was the next place to go as a science writer?
Really, there are three threads that come into this book. The first thread is the family story. It was undeniable. The second was cancer. So while this was happening in the background, while I was explaining to my would-be wife that there was this taint that ran through the family, that we should know about it and talk about it, I was also training as a cancer researcher. Cancer is a genetic disease, a disease unleashed by mutations in genes, and we were trying to figure out what genes cause cancer, why they cause cancer. And the last thread was that in the last 4 to 5 years, we have begun to invent technologies that allow us to change the human genome. And there's no other way to say it. That's the limit of the technology.
What's called CRISPR technology.
CRISPR is the forefront of them. There are waves that are following that. There's a whole family of technologies that allow this to happen. But yes, CRISPR is the centerpiece of that. And my lab began to work on CRISPR to understand cancer genes. And we're still doing a lot of work on CRISPR.
And what does that mean? What are you actually doing?
So what you're doing is that, very simply speaking, you're exploiting an ancient bacterial immune defense system that was invented to cut up the DNA of invading viruses. Now, what's important about that is that it doesn't cut up that invading virus DNA at random. It basically identifies a specific series of sequences that the virus carries, the code in the virus.
It targets it
and then chops it up like a pair of molecular scissors. But what was discovered in 2011, 2012, is that you could piggyback on that system and basically cut up any part of the human genome. That was number one. And number two is that the genome would try to repair itself. And in doing so, you could make it repair itself in whatever direction you want. Now, what does that mean? That means that you could take a mutant cystic fibrosis gene and you could say, I'm going to use this bacterial system and re-engineer it and now correct that mutant gene and make it the normal gene.
And the cystic fibrosis disappears.
The gene would disappear or be repaired and corrected. And not only would it be disappeared and corrected, if you did this in, for instance, embryonic stem cell or an embryonic cell, it would disappear permanently from your genetic lineage. It would vanish.
You have a great phrase that I have to think is a generative phrase for the book itself. At one point in the book, you call the human genome unsettlingly beautiful. What do you mean by that?
I mean, the human genome, if you read it, if you were to put it in a book, I describe it as a 66-volume encyclopedia, right? So it would be 66 volumes of the full Encyclopedia Britannica set.
Unique to each being.
Unique to each being, that's right. But if you were to open that volume, it would be totally inscrutable. It would look like gibberish. It's written in a code that is not easily understandable to humans. It's written in 4 letters, and it's written continuously like this for 3 billion letters. Now, what's unsettlingly beautiful about the human genome is that it takes that code, such simple code, ACT, GCT, TCCC, and it makes you and me out of that code. And obviously, there are certain things from the environment that we inherit, but it still creates this unbelievably complicated, adaptive, sly, beautiful creature that can paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel.
And adding to the picture of our fate as a physical being, as a mental being, is the factor of environment. Environment and random factors can change genetic outcome. Epigenetic switches can play a role in tripping off cancer, mental illness, many other diseases. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a very important discussion because it can become very polarizing. I mean, just take, for instance, the autism debate or the mental illness debate. You know, how much is gene, how much is environment? So let me just explain some very important terms. the first distinction is obviously between genetic information, the code that's written in ACT, GCC, and so forth, and a term that's being thrown around very loosely now called epigenetic information. So let me just explain. Epigenetics is a very simple idea. Epigenetics is a mechanism to alter that information without altering the sequence. So the sequence remains the same. So it does not change ACT, CG, GCC, and so forth. But you can package the DNA differently. So imagine, again, your genome is a long string. Well, you can tie knots in the string in certain places, and that would carry information if you tied knots along a certain string. You wouldn't change the string itself. All you're doing is tying three-dimensional knots.
But it would alter outcome.
It would alter outcome.
In what way, for example?
For example, if you were subjected to an acute starvation, it turns out that we now know that your gene sequence may not change when your body undergoes starvation. But in fact, it's possible that your epigene sequence, the way that the genome is knotted up, changes.
Well, at one point in your book, amazingly, your grandmother, who was not a scientist,
right,
blamed the stress of the partition of India for her own son's mental illness. And given what we know now about epigenetics and what you're just explaining, I wonder if in some sense, not just metaphorical, that she had a point.
And we know that there's a point there. We know that from formal studies, not the ones that carried out by my grandmother, but formal studies. You know, the best example of that is that you take two identical twins and you ask the question, what is the incidence of schizophrenia in both those twins? And the incidence of schizophrenia is around 50%. So what does that tell us? It tells us, number one, that there's a strong genetic component. That's about 50-fold higher than the general population. So there's clearly a genetic component. But on the flip side, you could ask the question, well, why did the other twin, 50% of the time, not have the disease? Well, the answer is either it's because of some environmental trigger that was missing. Maybe it was random chance, but still a random environmental trigger that was missing that made it possible in one twin and not in the other twin. And so the point of the book is that we're realizing that what we used to call fate or destiny is really a combination of random chance and environmental triggers impinging on the genome.
That even comes to the point of sexuality. The book discusses the hunt for the so-called gay gene. Mm-hmm. What's the latest thinking on that? Because I know that that's come up any number of times in the last 15, 20 years. And how did the publicity around that debate shape the course of gay rights in this country?
So one question that we keep coming back to over and over again in the book is that, you know, you might think naively that genetics is a scientific problem or a scientific question. The point here is that genetics is reorganizing in a radical way the way we think about race, the way we think about sexuality, identity, you know, transgenderism, all the stuff that is raging, the divisive debates that are raging in the political realm.
That are seemingly a cultural debate.
That are seemingly cultural debates, are political debates, are really debates about human beings and identity. And if they are debates about human beings and identity, then they have to be debates about genes. It's ipso facto, they're debates about genes. So coming to your question about the gay gene, as you know, it's a big deal in the 1980s and 1990s to figure out the extent to which sexuality was genetically determined or whether it was a choice. We know quite a lot about those answers now. Well, the first thing that we know, and the most important thing that we know, is that if you look at, again, at identical twins, there is a strong concordance, which would clearly suggest that there is a genetic component.
It must frustrate the hell out of you to listen to the current discourse about any number of these issues, whether it's identity or sexuality, because it always seems to leave out the scientific component.
It's not only frustrating, it is dangerous.
How so?
Just to take the debates around race. You know, you in this last cycle of elections, the word race has been thrown around on a daily basis. Well, first of all, let's ask ourselves, what do we know about race? Well, we know quite a lot, actually, about race in a genetic or biological sense. We know, for instance, that if you look genetically at intra-racial diversity, that is, if you take Africa as a continent, and you ask the question, what's the genetic difference between a man from Namibia and a man from Egypt, say, that genetic difference we know is greater than the genetic difference between Africans and Europeans, not by a small amount, but by a vast amount.
Why would that be?
Well, that's just the way that human beings have evolved. The evolution of human beings allowed certain dispersals of humans, and race follows the lines of those dispersals. And so the intra-racial diversity within continents or so-called races exceeds the interracial diversity. And so therefore, you can actually say very little about what the word race means. So let me just finish up by one important comment. And this is the point that it's very important to drive home in this debate. I can look at your genome and tell with quite a great degree of accuracy whether you were born, whether your ancestors were born in a particular place in Eastern Europe, and what their racial geography might have been. The point is you can't do the opposite. In other words, you cannot take a racial geography, you can't say Eastern Europe, and make very much sense of the people who descend down that lineage because it's so diverse. So as I say in the book, the genomic geographer goes home happy. The racist has nothing to ask for or to say for it.
Well, let's go back to the idea of genetic engineering and our ability, using CRISPR and things like it, to potentially edit the human genome as we see fit. This is, as you've said, an enormously powerful moment in the history of science, and yet we're in the midst of a presidential election, and this is not an issue that's come up not once. Do you think our politics or anybody's politics are capable of grappling with something this consequential?
Well, you know, it's been discussed in the sidelines, not by the candidates, but it's very much in the zeitgeist. So just to give you one example, there was a moratorium that's been placed in the United States against the interventions on the human genome in embryonic cells or embryonic stem cells or embryos using CRISPR technology. So the scientists have said, you know, we don't know very much about this. Let's hold off until we figure out some of the ethical.
This is kind of an intellectual and an ethical break.
It's an intellectual and ethical break. But just to give you one example, it's not clear whether the Chinese scientists are interested in that same break. It's not clear whether the Korean scientists are. Someone is going to do proof of principle experiments in which they say, in principle, in a human embryo, you can change the genome in a directional manner. You know, it's kind of like creating a designer genome.
But is there a human being alive who is not constricted by religious considerations, say, that wouldn't want to make this leap? You have relatives that suffer from mental illness. I have a child with autism. I have to think that everybody we know, everybody, has something like this in their lives.
Yes, but I'm the human being, I think, and maybe you are too. I think we should all be who are human beings who are so concerned about what's happened in the past that we need to define moral red lines.
But how will we be able to resist?
How will we be able to resist?
Considering the suffering that we both know in this room and that is in the world in general.
I think we'll be able to do this by having a frank discussion about what those moral red lines would be. I propose in the book that it should be a triangle, that the triangle should be, on one hand, extraordinary suffering. So in other words, we need to decide what genetic illnesses, what genetic blemishes cause truly extraordinary suffering, so that we're not, for instance, trying to make blonde babies or blue-eyed babies.
No, but there's a great in-between. We now live in a world in which there's a discussion of difference rather than suffering. So you have a community, for example, people who are deaf.
Yes.
Argue that this is a different way, some of them, that this is merely a different way of being rather than an imperfect form of quote-unquote normalcy. You have it with any number of conditions.
Absolutely. And so the point being that as long as those debates are raging and if they're legitimate, if we find them even within the boundaries of reason, which, for instance, I do in the case of deafness, then those are open for discussion.
Are those national debates? Are they international debates? How are they conducted?
Well, let's start with at least them being national debates. I mean, international, as I said already, you know, cultures like the Chinese, famously, the Chinese, flatly, some scientists in China have said, we don't want the moratorium. We don't care about this moratorium. We have different values. We don't think the embryo is that sacred. Not because we're evil human beings, but because we just don't, our values are different, our systems of belief are different, and most importantly, we want to cure terrible diseases.
It makes you think, even if you're a child of enlightenment and science and rationality, that the responsibility inherited by discoveries like the atomic discovery or the genetic discovery is almost too much for the fragile human intelligence and moral structure to absorb sometimes.
Well, I would hope not, because we have to absorb it.
There's no choice.
That there's no choice. I think we are facing right up to it. This is a human debate. This is a debate that lies in the humanities as much as in the sciences. It lies in politics as much as in the sciences. You cannot say, oh, you know, scientists will solve that problem. You have to solve the problem. You have to find out. That's why you need the vocabulary. You need the vocabulary of genes. You need to figure out what race means. You need to figure out what epigenetics means. You need to figure out all of this stuff. If you don't, you'll be left out of this debate.
That was David Remnick talking with Siddhartha Mukherjee.